I'm honored to introduce Mark Seely to you. You already saw him. He came over from London this morning and will join us in a panel discussion about the politics of the image, politics of performance tomorrow. Opening this panel with a clear focus on image politics, his talk is announced as a keynote lecture for the whole of this conference. Mark Seely has received strong acknowledgement, documented by numerous invitations for guest lectures and commission work in the UK and abroad. He was highly acclaimed by critics, for example, for Different, his book published in 2002, and prestigious awards, the Hood Medal by the Photographic Society. His work is especially valuable for our considerations and discussions, and it will, I'm sure, receive our strong attention within this conference and beyond. As a director of Autograph ABP, which stands for the Association of Black Photographers in London, Mark Seely represents the exceptional work of this organization, which is operating worldwide on a global range. Autograph ABP opens a platform for and initiates autographic counter-practices, exhibitions, historical research, documentation and debate for and about black photographers on a global range. It provides visibility, integration and discourse for and about the present, past and possible future of racial and ethnical groups and individuals who share a black identity. To give some theoretical parameter about this term, I would quote from the similar book Different, published by Mark Seely and Stuart Hall in 2002. Black does not reference to a particular group with fixed characteristics whose social being or artistic imagination is determined by skin color, genetic makeup, or biological inheritance. It does not invoke an essentialized cultural identity frozen in time, which is automatically transmitted into the work and can thus be held to represent collectively all those who belong to a particular race, ethnic community, or tradition. Black, as deployed here, is a politically, historically, culturally constructed category, a contested idea whose ultimate destinations remain unsettled. The exhibition of autographic counter-practices, as well as the re-evaluation of historical representation of blackness, focuses on making visible a reality of profound difference of history, culture, and experience beyond stereotypes and epitomization. Last term stems from Franz Fanon, and mark a site of a long struggle within the image to find a new identity to the black subject. This struggle within the realms of visual representation may be illustrated by a quote from Wayne Dars, which shall introduce Mark Seely's talk, The Organ That Weeps. So, welcome, Mark Seely.
Thanks very much. Well, that's one of the longest introductions I've had, so thank you very much. And it's a pleasure to be here, and thanks for the invitation. And just to echo the thanks for the interpretive work that's been done for the conference, probably doing the hardest job today. Anyway, I'm probably going to structure the talk in two kind of halves. In a sense, there's a kind of historical thing which will happen through quite a lot of slides. And then halfway through the slides, there'll be a more focused kind of analysis of some of the work we've been doing with Autograph. I mean, in many ways, I mean, I suppose, as we kind of develop this kind of question about visual culture, and recently I've been reading a lot of Wayne Dars's work, and this idea about the work that the eye does, I suppose, is kind of fundamental to some of the questions that we've been asking over time. So how does one bear witness to the criminality of societal rule, which consigns the uniqueness of being to eternal forgetfulness, not through the act of dramatic transgression, but through a descent into everyday life? Thus, how does one not simply articulate loss through a dramatic gesture of defiance, but learn to inhabit the world or inhabit it again in a gesture of mourning? It is in this context that one may identify the eye, not as the organ that sees, but as the organ that weeps. And that had a kind of profound resonance for me, really, because in many ways a lot of the work that we've been doing is melancholic in its nature. Historically, it's been about identifying, if you like, a place, a comfort zone, to be able to imagine a self without it being kind of torn apart or contested or representative of any one or any given perspective. I mean, I'm going to keep on going backwards and forwards in time. I'm also very interested in the very specific moment that 1839 represents with the invention of photography. I think in many ways we forget it's actually not that long ago, the invention of this medium. And I'm also interested in the forces that were at play around 1839. What was the world doing and how was the world imagining itself? What was actually going on within visual culture? And what were the political forces that were running through? I think it's interesting when we look at what's happening across the internet and places like that today, but there have always been interventionists. I mean, people like William Blake were making work as a kind of counter-cultural voice against the barbarity of slavery way back in 1879. So it's important to look at, 1796. It's important to look at work, I suppose, that has been kind of contesting the place that we imagine our futures within. If we look at 1839, and we look at one of the grandest events that actually happened, the abolition of slavery, I mean, you can imagine that the abolition of slavery is 1838, and 1839, just 5 months later, photography enters the world. So it's funny, in our imaginations, I believe, that slavery seems to be so far away, and yet photography seems to be so near. So I'm interested in how we close these kind of temporal gaps across how history works. It's almost as if slavery was kind of yesteryear. No one really wants to talk about it. But with the invention of photography, the invention of visualising the world, it seems to be very, very, very close to us. The documents are alive. The history is very much profound. But other histories and other moments, if you like, are simply neglected. So this idea of time is very important, I think, when we talk about formulations of otherness, especially when we look at ideas around the Enlightenment, for example, and the contradictions that are at play within kind of Enlightenment ideologies. Here we have a world that is trying to present itself, or thinkers globally, across North America, across Europe, coming out of academic traditions, that are, if you like, trying to say, we're going to forget the old way. We're going to forget the old barbaric traditions. We're going to forget about religion. We're going to forget about myths. We're going to forget about graven idol images. And we're going to go forward with ideas. Go forward with ideas, but at the same time, we're going to propagate a hierarchical world that enables us to exploit the other and bend, if you like, ideologies to suit, if you like, an imperial objective. And the imperial objective had a very specific way of seeing the world. Obsessions with the body. I mean, I think when we've been working across the question of identity politics, the body surfaces very quickly. Obsessions with how the body is made up, what are the primary drivers for it, what are the racial imperatives behind it, why do we spend so much time trying to unpack, if you like, what's underneath the surface, and why do we spend so much time historically constructing an epidermal schema of things, which in a sense are hugely problematic when we consider how, in Levinas's terms, how we take responsibility for the other. Again, a kind of this question about intervention. Artists such as Turner making, if you like, public statements. I think it's when we think about the images which we looked at earlier from Benetton, I think it's equally horrific to look at what Turner was trying to do with representation of slaves being thrown over a ship. I mean, a very kind of controversial painting within its day, which is a direct act of supporting the abolitionist movement. An act which, in a sense, was probably kind of, you know, career-breaking, or potentially career-breaking for Turner at the time, because he was seen as actually supporting something that was incredibly problematic with regards to the imperial powers and British government at the time. And it's interesting that this work starts to appear in public almost simultaneously that the photography is invented. The questions that have been asked historically around race simply don't go away. It's interesting that in 1900, Du Bois and his big exhibition in Paris, his award-winning exhibitions in Paris, were trying to provide evidence of a Negro type, trying to provide an image, if you like, that enabled the world, millions of people who saw the exhibition, to imagine that it could be, or that they could understand, that the black subject was a human being. This is a question that's been asked 110 years ago. In many ways, contemporary artists are still working through this question, still working through this idea that humanity, or the humanity of the African subject or the black subject, used in the widest possible term, is something that we still have to fight for and contest. The whole legacy, if you like, of the position of servitude has a long visual tradition, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with. So many of these images are either popular, or the type of image, which I'm interested in, the type of image, whether this is an image from 1850 in the southern states, or whether it's an image from David Goldblatt in apartheid South Africa. There are echoes of this type of construction of image throughout photographic history. This ties in with some of the kind of issues that we were beginning to deal with as students in the 80s, beginning to look at how the art world was formulating or not formulating the work that we were making. How are we going to create a countercultural voice through photographic images that allowed ourselves to recreate the black subject in a way that is a little bit more profound, if you like, a little bit more complex than what had historically been given? That had historically been given is mainly and ultimately a pathetic, debased, acultural subject. I think it's the constant reference, if you like, within that point. I mean, this is an imagined scenario where Queen Victoria gives an African savage a Bible, giving, if you like, this kind of gift of Western culture. I mean, it's an imagined act, it never happened, but it's a painting that is celebrated and still hung within the National Portrait Gallery in London. So in the context of the story behind this painting, is never given to the public when they encounter it. So again, it's part of a long legacy of the kind of construction of an African-Western kind of dialogue. And it's always a dialogue that's kind of historically been weighted. And I think this historical weight, in terms of the dialogue of the construction of images, is never really put on the table in clear terms. Someone today showed a map of the internet, and I think when we think about the internet, we think about who has access to the internet. There's an assumption that it is a global phenomenon. It's not. Large parts of the world don't have access to the internet. Something like 5% of Africans have access to it. And mobile phones are not everywhere. And I think the pathetic, debased subject, these images for me do two kinds of work. In one way, you want to kind of look at them and think it's great that they're out there and that they actually do surface in the world. But at the same time, they provide us with a long trajectory of a typical type of image of which the black subject had been framed within. A long trajectory of looking at the construction of the black subject as seen as pathetic and never in control, or never having the means of production to produce their own image, as Stuart Hall says, to imagine themselves in a way that enables themselves to feel free and competent. I think the means of reproduction are really quite central to debates even today. Of course, we know the work that anthropology has done. We know the measuring devices that were employed. And we know that in many senses, the literal stripping down of the individual to provide data for how these people could be classified, not as cultural subjects, but simply as bodies in flesh, has been a long legacy and, if you like, a dark side on what photography kind of represents. interesting that Alice Seeley Harris's work, these in theory, I believe, are the first images that were used in an international campaign against Leopold Kongo. Alice Seeley was a missionary, and she spent time working with the local people, documenting their existences, and produced the Lantern slideshow that ran across the United States and Europe around 1905. I think it's interesting when we look at these in terms of seemingly shocking images at the turn of the century, educating enlightened Europeans that these people were caught in under these conditions. This photograph shows Alice on top of a pyramid, literally a pyramid of black children. The evangelical zest of the kind of missionary act isn't really questioned in Alice's work at all. The idea that she was taking responsibility for producing photographic acts is, if you like, an incisive moment in terms of pulling apart Leopold's Belgian regime, the Congo regime, but at the same time it replicates, if you like, a fault line in the reproduction or the replication of the African subject. This image I've thrown in really because it's typical of, if you like, the anthropologist at work. He's collecting his material, he's building knowledge for us to actually share over time. And of course the volumes become collectible and disseminated and become kept in libraries. I think the question of where and how genocides, if you like, have occurred across the continent is often forgot, is often negated. And I think the violence that photography actually replicates, the cultural violence that photography enables us to encounter, is often negated and taken for granted. The idea that, you know, that the black subject was commodified, and the commodification of the African or the Negro subject in this case is a long-standing kind of history. The trajectory of it, in many senses, hasn't gone away. It may well change in terms of the physicality of the actual black body being for sale, but the commodification of race is an important contemporary marker, which I think we should re-examine at important times. How do we use race to sell? These photographs from a series of postcards from Without Lynching, Without Sanctuary. It's interesting about these images, some of you may well know them or not, but they were actually circulated as postcards and collected by a guy called James Allen in the South. These were images which were signed on the back and sent to friends and relatives as mementos for people after they were hanged, predominantly black people, but not exclusively. This photograph's an important photograph in this moment because it shows the event, the children smiling, the fact that it was a good day out, the events in many ways were advertised, and people knew and expected the lynching to occur at a certain time. The debasement of... I'm fascinated by Fanon, of course, by the very nature of my work, and Algeria's particular case. But I think it's interesting that the war crimes against women it only really came into play around about 1998. And I think this image, in a sense, has all kinds of echoes from the types of images we've been seeing coming out of Iraq and Iran now. So it's not unusual within soldiers' kind of picture portfolios to reproduce this type of image. And then we enter the kind of subject of contemporary African art. We enter into a place where the world imagines, or the museums begin to think about the display of the African object and begin to encounter, if you like, or think about what these images could possibly mean or how they begin to interpret them. It's interesting when we look at I think the word Africa for me now is even problematic. I think even just saying it, I'm not sure what it even means because it comes with so much baggage. It's almost as if it drives people mad. I'm not even sure whether you can say it in any meaningful way without it causing a kind of visual dynamic that sends people slightly wild. You end up with museums and very intelligent people wanting to recreate African cafes in their buildings, or wanting to have drumming every time there's an African artist on display, or wanting to have postcards that are red, yellow and green. Somehow it drives people completely crazy, this idea that if you encounter the continent, you've got to get to some form of essential otherness. Okay, so the theatre of Africa is really problematic. And something that I've learned through kind of curatorial practices, what do you do with African artists if you don't actually mention the term Africa? What happens to the work? You're forced to look at it through the prism of other references, rather than these imagined constructions. This is the work of Sadio Keita, but in 1991, when this work was shown, it's interesting to note that, of course, it's a couple from the 1950s, that the photographer is from Bamako, that it's a silver print from 1974, it's from an original negative. So it wouldn't have needed much further curatorial research and development to find out who actually took that photograph. So the objectification of the subject and the negation of the author is an important historical legacy that happens with that with display of African art. Okay, very soon after this, André Magnan and the team supported by Bagotzi, a major collector of African art, go into Bamako, easily identify Sadio Keita, and Sadio Keita's work now is selling for thousands of dollars for limited edition prints at a variety of different sizes and scales. What's happening within the image isn't discussed at all. This very particular phenomenon of twinning, which Stephen Sprague describes very well through his anthropological research, isn't discussed. No one wants to interrogate the work that the work is doing. Okay, it's almost as if it's enough in this context just to accept the fact that the object of photography in itself arrives within the museum context. Very little work in the early 90s was done in decoding these images. It's almost as if people didn't have the intellectual capacity or the knowledge to start to begin to unearth or even unpick what was going on within this photographic agenda. Put in Terry Smith's quote, because I think it's a very important one, this idea of erasing habitats, the idea that, you know, you absolutely annihilate a culture by overtaking, by simply taking everything out of it, by leaving nothing behind other than a framework for Western rationality, sets up a kind of fantasy scenario where the only thing that's left is a noble savage. Without any history, without any past, where acts of brutal murder are taken for granted because they're seen within some legacy of cultural progression. You end up still today with artists like Samuel Fosso. This is the artist. And I think, you know, sometimes artists make incredible bad decisions. Samuel was encouraged to replicate one of his photographs by sitting in the window of Selfridges on Oxford Street and recreate a live photograph that he'd made. Now, of course, the echoes of that are huge in terms of the display of the African subject through world fairs. I can't imagine someone like Richard Avedon being invited to restage himself as one of his photographs. So there's degrees of the lack of parity across this has all kinds of echoes of the way that cultural powers are at play when we think about race, and in particular the African continent. We end up with magazines like Revue Noir, very important magazines, as theatres and platforms for displaying work, but displaying work predominantly within a romantic tradition, allowing the work to simply, if you like, replicate historical renderings of the way that this work has been articulated. This in many ways now becomes the backdrop for some of the work that we wanted to start to try and produce through the prism of developing an agency that would internally interrogate the question and underlying principle of representational kind of politics around identity and racial politics, around the very subject of blackness. How does one create a space which enables us to articulate and critique, if you like, what's going on within these images? Not necessarily what's going on within the images, but try to create an alternative voice and pull apart, if you like, this documentary tradition that had left us with an image bank that is hugely problematic, that doesn't give us the tools to begin to address the subtle nuances of what's at play with the reproduction of this type of work. This, if you like, escalating machine that keeps on turning round the same place, that keeps on arriving with this fascination on the black body. And at the same time, we begin to, you know, recognize that there are healthy, vibrant, indigenous African photography traditions that are in places like Drum Magazine, that South Africa and what happened through Drum Magazine by commissioning, you know, a lot of African photographers to produce work, is somehow falls in to this place of exotic reproduction, falls into this history of never been able to be seen or unpacked from its place. It's almost as if the photographers themselves could consciously or unconsciously replicate the problems that have historically been laid on the table for us to look at. NKA magazine arrives in the early 90s at the same time that we were at play and begins for the first time, if you like, to provide an intellectual framework for the discussion and debate around the subtleties and nuances of representational politics. It's interesting the words like identities and boundaries and race, gender, white myths, black looks, you know, start to become part of the curatorial framework in which people begin to interrogate and almost, if you like, start to explode images. Start to create a framework where you can begin to maybe, just maybe, ask a different set of questions about what's happening and begin to commission new writing around these perspectives was fundamental to a lot of the early work that we were doing at Autograph. And then finally, within this set of slides, we have to ask ourselves, what happens when, you know, Malik Seribeh from Mali wins the Lifetime Achievement Medal in Venice? What are the forces at play behind that award? I'll leave that as a question, actually. So Autograph is launched in 1988, predominantly by, if you like, a generation of students who had gone through art school, who'd come out of those art schools with their degrees at hand, and were looking around the art world and quite simply couldn't see the work that they were doing replicated in any of the institutions. What happened was that we began to build an alliance. We began to kind of make a strategic intervention across the public sector. So the public sector has been fundamentally weak. Weak because it didn't have policies. Weak because it didn't really understand the complexities of what was happening within its own urban environments. Weak because it never imagined that there would be a body that would challenge spaces like the British Museum. Weak because it never imagined that it would actually ask for a percentage of its population funding back. The simple argument was that if 4% of the population are black, in the widest possible sense, why can't we have 4% of the funding? Why not? In the most logical argument, what's the problem with that? There were no answers to that. We mobilised people like Stuart Hall, Linda Bellis, local councillors, Pradeep De Palma, people who had actually been in the UK for quite a long time, and Stuart Hall became a leading light in the theorisation of the work that we were doing, literally writing the theory on the ground. You know, photographic practices are always historically specific. They belong to particular conjunctions. Black self-portraiture in this historical moment has broken many of its links with the dominant Western humanist celebration of the self. And has become more of a staking of a claim. Now, nobody knew what the staking of the claim was. Nobody imagined that there was a position that you knew what the destination was. Most people felt as though, in terms of the artists that we were working with, that something needed to be taken back. That was the act. And in that kind of construction, if you like, the idea of taking back something, the act simply in many instances, whether they were right or wrong, meant replicating the kind of images that were already out there, but changing the nature of the authorship. Now that, in a sense, began to talk about the problems, if you like, of the documentary tradition. How do you talk about an authentic black perspective? These were things that were happening, and recreate the things that were already out there. There are those at home and people that I've worked with who imagine that you can tell the race, the gender, the sexual orientation, and probably the social status of the photographer through the images, which is a bit of a ridiculous ask in the understanding or unpacking of any photograph. But there are those that have made a career out of being, if you like, spokespeople, visual spokespeople for their communities by producing positive images. This was the time when positive and negative images were very much in circulation. Black photographers produced positive images of their communities, and white photographers produced negative images of their communities. People were very polemic in those moments. I was always very uncomfortable with the idea that within the work that we were doing, that race should even have, or i.e. the epidermal schema of things, should be a player in the politics of what we were saying. My political allegiances went beyond the idea of the black subject and into the kind of social subject. Ultimately, underneath what I was beginning to think about was, how do we even problematize the very question of the black subject? What are we actually saying in that moment, and how do we frame it, literally? The question of modernity was an underlying kind of theoretical kind of problematic. What, you know, within visual art theory or within visual art history, this idea of modernity or the black subject's lack of modernity was an ongoing question. So we were beginning to embrace this idea that if we're going to create a new identity, if we're going to put identities on the table, then we have to frame and post them beyond the idea of being locked within the confines of historical concepts of modernity. Creating was a critical decade, and using terms like black British photography provided a platform to actually speak from. It meant that curators and galleries could simply digest what we were talking about. Okay? These are not definitive moments. In my mind, there is no such thing as black British photography. In my mind, there is no such thing as black photography. But when you found that you were, you know, taking a portfolio of artists into the public realm, the way that most curators or galleries could understand it was through the prism of otherness, through the prism of, oh yeah, great, look at these black photographers. That's new, that's exciting. Okay? So there's strategies of deployment that enable people to be part of the process. Look what I discovered today. Okay? And actually, once you actually get into the space, the idea of problematizing what's been discovered today was part of the role that we had to play as kind of agents for change. Agents for change, not just externally, but agents for change across, as we said, within those communities. What do you do within a black community, if you like, if there is such a thing as a black community that is essentially homophobic within its kind of discourse? It doesn't understand or want to tolerate difference within itself. It is very happy to marginalize the other within itself. Okay, that it's conservative in its very nature. It simply replicates the forces that are out there. So we began to produce shows that were touring shows. We began to commission work, and we began to fight and contest the Arts Council for funding. And we were very successful in those lobbies, in many ways. And we were very fortunate that the Arts Council was in turmoil at that point, that was responding, if you like, to the social forces that were at play. This is the height of Thatcherism. And most liberal, enlightened people were not subscribing to what Thatcher was doing in Britain. One of the good things about Thatcher is that she created a space where marginalised, disenfranchised people from the creative sectors felt as though they could come together and have a common enemy. Okay, that was Thatcherism. What New Labour did, or what happened post that, and as the left became more centre, is that the opposition became very grey. No one knew where they were anymore. And these binary politics had gone. You know, you knew who the enemy was. They were the bankers, they were the wealthy, they were the rich. And on the left, they were gays, lesbians, blacks, working class, socialists, and intellectuals that were Marxists and, you know, framing new dynamics. So we were all bound, if you like, by an oppositional voice. And if you like, within the Arts Council itself, that oppositional voice was beginning to seep up by those that had their hands on the funding strings. I'm a great believer that institutions are actually got nothing to do with institutional raison d'etre, their purpose. It's to do with the individuals within institutions that make those institutions change. So in time, we've been very fortunate with individuals who kind of get the message that we were trying to like put across. And the message was, you know, if we're going to look at a society that is massively cosmopolitan, with towns like Liverpool, Manchester, London, Birmingham in particular, with complex kind of social formations literally being made, with people marrying across the colour line and children being born of, you know, biracial categories, very sensitive term. Language, in a sense, was hugely sensitive. Never mind what you were actually doing with it. To actually look at someone and try and name them was a hugely kind of complex game. Political correctness. So we were playing, if you like, in the field of race as well. We were looking at what younger artists were trying to do, but at the same time, also making these global allegiances. Global allegiances that were really important to us because we had a network already there. I realised very early on that if you've got all these migrant communities within your city, then you can actually tap back to their homelands very, very quickly. So working in Bangladesh became very easy. Working in India became very easy. Working in South Africa became very easy. Working in places like the Caribbean became very easy. Commissioning local people. This was a show that we did in 93 where we gave in Dhaka, Bangladesh, a group of women cameras for the first time to begin to produce an image of themselves and throw it back out in Dhaka as an exhibition, so that, if you like, the audience, the local audience, could engage with these very kind of complex images that these women were building. For the first time, it was a public exhibition where Bangladeshi Muslim women were able to interrogate their own space. Okay? In retrospect, it's a really simple initiative. In 1993, no one had done this. Okay? And the idea that two or three of these women are still photographers going on is an achievement which has marked their careers. They became journalists in this moment. It's those little interventions. See, I mean, in many ways, autograph is about small bites of a big picture. Okay, it's about trying to lay a template down. You know, and then if we begin to look at what was going away, I mean, history is really important to the work that we've been doing. I mean, photographers, in this instance, Vincent Stokes, his father had died, and he realised that there was no good image of his dad. You know, an important part. I mean, imagine that moment when you think your father's gone and there isn't an image of him to actually live with, the one that you can actually celebrate and circulate. So what he did is he at the funeral, he identified all of his father's friends and he set up a series of large portraits, larger than life portraits, and documented in a way which filled that visual gap. Missing kind of histories, okay? Kind of missing chapters, missing visual points. Strategically, we've always been able to, you know, introduce international stars into the field. So working with Gordon Parks on national touring shows was part of what we did in terms of raising the popularity of what the organisation was about. Again, a strategic intervention. Limited resources, occasionally you have to work with a pop star. You get press, you get credibility, you get advocacy for the organisation, and actually, ironically, it was shameless, really, that someone like Gordon Parks had never had a one-person exhibition in London. So it's staging and opening those doors, working in France on a major audiovisual in the amphitheatre was a groundbreaking event. Ironically, it was easier to sell or to invent the idea of black Britishness abroad. In places like Brazil. And of course you ask the question very kind of very, very subtly, but what are you doing about the image of your migrant population in that moment? This idea of Europe has been an ongoing kind of contestation for many artists. But you know, we were commissioning work now that enabled artists to look at the very notion of fortress Europe, to look at how these boundaries were beginning to be put up around them. To create, if you like, for the first time, an articulate voice from black subjects that position themselves as Europeans. Beginning to unpack at this point in time with this exhibition, pairing artists with artists from Spain and from the UK who were dealing with similar things, opening up the doors, if you like, around visual connections rather than just racial connections. Pilar Alvar's work is all about the surreal, and Claudette Holmes' work, which this photograph represents, was also playing into that, but also replicating those twinning photographs from Africa. Working with artists like Dawood Bey, again creating spaces where the work gets commissioned, And it's held and worked with places like the National Portrait Gallery. This work by Anthony Lamb has become a very important historical document because this was the first time that an Anglo-Chinese artist had been working with local Bangladeshi kids who were becoming, if you like, the new Negroes in London. They were becoming the new threat to the streets. These were the new gangs. This was the East End. This was a community of kids around 1995 that nobody knew what to do with. There was a new Docklands Light Railway being built, and we positioned these photographs on the train, and we had series of complaints about these photographs by the workers who were going to Canary Wharf as to why they should have to look at these Bangladeshi boys while they're on the way to work. It's an interesting exercise. Brought to me Fanny Coyote, who was the first chairman of Autograph, really. We look after his estate now, but you know, I mean, what do you do with his work has a particular resonance for all of the problems that we had. In many ways, he was an outsider in terms of his sexuality, an outsider in terms of his geographical location, and an outsider in terms of the aspirations that his family had for him. Living in London as a gay man, he dies in 89. He leaves a very interesting body of work, and the family at this moment in time want to take the work and bury it because of their homophobia. We intervene, we salvage the work, we're at contestation with the family, there's a huge kind of battle around who owns it, and eventually we salvage the work and archive it, and now it's highly collectible and it's showing internationally. This is what I mean by, if you don't make those interventions, you can't step to those people, if you don't have those agencies, the work simply goes away. Van der Zee's work, most of you are familiar with. But, you know, we're interested in this very idea of, you know, the image of Black America and then creating, if you like, whatever happened to Harlem, the show asked. Whatever happened to 1920s Harlem? Whatever happened to this image of a Black American in 1920? So this kind of like construction of the other, really. Well, I always believed, in many ways, that the photographs were there. It was a case of just excavating them and putting them within a context where people could imagine that this is the historical trajectory which we looked at was not in a set, was simply a myth. I'm very interested in, you know, how do we find curatorially, how do we find this work? And now really a lot of the work that we're doing is about creating a space where missing chapters begin to fold onto each other. We have a huge archive project running right now for the next 2 years. It's 2 years into it, and we'll carry on for the next 2 years, where we're encouraging this question of vernacular photography to come into the agency, where we believe that the points of the representational points of the communities that we want to talk to, which are very wide and far-reaching, are not through the official photographer's lens, are actually through the spaces and places of the vernacular. That's what we mean by the missing chapter. Stephen James is, of course, a white liberal Californian who spent ages working with the Panther Party. I think it's interesting, you see, time and time and time again, we keep on coming to this place where you can't actually talk about the very essence of a black subject working in these spaces, of a black photographer working in these spaces. There's been far too many encounters, okay? Encounters which are really, really important, which can't be which cannot just simply equate to the position of the person politically or racially and their construction of a view. Estácio Neves is a very interesting Brazilian photographer that we've worked with. Interestingly, again, this idea of extracting him, giving him a show in London, and then enabling him to go back to Brazil as a celebrated photographic figure is a strategic act. Because in Brazil, he would never have had the recognition that he deserved unless we'd actually focused on him. The cultural industries cannot work like that. They're very lazy. Amy Gaston-Lee's project. This project, again, had a particular resonance because very clearly these are the children of African Americans who were soldiers during the Vietnam War. And as they left this legacy behind them. And yet these children have the hardest route back into America, even though racially they're quite clearly of African-American descent. So we've been commissioning work, producing and publishing work now since 1988. We've been moving through, trying to create, if you like, a body of work, a body of evidence as the agency, a kind of new archive, a nuance of images, and a myriad of kind of like different perspectives that allow, that have in theory always had the agenda of uncoupling what we feel as though there's been an underlying weight of pulling, you know, an underlying weight that pulls the both this representational field below the surface back into tradition. It's almost as if there's this kind of conflict. And I'm watching this conflict grow again when we talk about Islamic kind of cultures in the UK. It's almost as if there's this replicative field that wants to construct this type, this stereotype, that keeps on pulling us back to these polemic positions. And I'm interested in resisting those forces, if you like. And I think photography is probably most suited to doing that. Resisting those forces, because the choices, if you don't resist those forces, the choices outside of that are divided spaces and conflict. Now, once you get past the idea of not wanting to live within divided spaces and conflict, and once you get past the idea of racial politics, i.e. talking about a subject from a very particular political point of view, you end up in very different places. And the place that I think that we're arriving at now is seriously looking at what do we do, how do we take the debate from identity politics, race and representation, through to this question of civil rights, and through ultimately to the question of human rights. What do we do about the declarations that are signed in 1948? How do we map on those rights once we get past the question of race? And if you start talking about one's rights, the subject, then you're in a particularly different field of work. It enables us as an organisation, once we start talking about human rights, to move beyond the prism of race, because all of a sudden people get it. All of a sudden people become, hold on a minute, yes, this is a human right. We're talking about a human subject here rather than a racial field. And by working with artists now who are kind of, I'm going to move very quickly because I'm aware of time, working with artists now, today, currently, who are really trying to focus on this question of human rights within the work, it enables a much wider perspective to kind of be unfolded on the historical spaces that we've been looking at. I suppose what the question of human rights does is it enables us to kind of think really quite clearly about the responsibility that you and I have for the subject that's in the critical condition. I'm not going to talk about Agamben's work and Hormoz Cezaire. Most theoretical work has been tapped in it. It's very interesting that a lot of people now, a lot of theory now is beginning to embrace the subject of human rights. I mean, human rights activists and human rights theory has not done the visual very well. I do think there's a kind of cultural gap there somewhere. It's almost as if human rights can't work, human rights activists can't work with the image. So I think I'm very interested in that space, and that's the kind of research I'm doing now. I think people like Ariella Azule and her work with Civil Contract to Photography is a very interesting publication. The first two or three chapters of her book, if you haven't read it, take some time to at least read the first 100 pages, because she talks about the photographer's civil contract with the subject in frame. So it becomes interesting. This is a book that's published by MIT, by the way. So it becomes another exercise in what do we do about responsibility? What do we do about taking control of the situation that we're at? How do we actually unfold, as individuals, our responsibility? What act do you take? And that's a question that I would kind of ask us all to kind of like think about. When we think about intervention, what act do we do? And intervene on what? And that's what I was kind of teasing with. It's like, what is the destination? Where do you go? Where do you want to go? And what part of the journey are you prepared to commit to? Okay? And if that journey means that you're prepared to take risks, or you're building what in a society that does what work for you and how, what does that look like, and who are you bringing with you? Okay. Really, that's the underlying principle of some of the things that I'm interested in. I became very cynical around 98, around this question of race. And I did one show. We have a Windrush sequence at home. Most of you guys won't understand what the Windrush means. The Windrush was a boat that arrived from Jamaica in 1948, and it brought 300 Jamaicans with it. And it's seen as a landmark moment in the arrival of West Indian communities within the UK. So it's historically significant. I know that, you know, black people have been in the UK for centuries before that, so I was thinking, why did people get so excited about 300 Jamaicans arriving on a boat? Okay, but it's just the way that history works. So, in a cynical moment, there was an opportunity to work with this gallery to deliver an exhibition, and I had contacts at Holt and Getty, who had all these wonderful images of these people unpacking their belongings at Waterloo Station. And I thought, okay, we'll do this, and we'll make the show happen, and everyone will be happy. We can fund it, we can work with it. It gets the work done. There's a certain degree of expectation around that. But I made a fundamental mistake, which changed the direction of which the work that I was doing in. At the exhibition, two people arrived, and there's no, it doesn't matter who they are, but they're fairly heavyweight academics, and I asked them to introduce the show. And the audience that night was very specific, because what I realised actually, that this is living memory, right? They're identifying themselves in the space, and here I am, arrogant enough to think, this is so far away, who needs this, why play with that? But watching people literally identify themselves and cry in the space was a profound moment of recognition. It was almost as if they kind of had never had the opportunity to celebrate that moment, had never been given a visual kind of map of which they could identify with. So I realized actually that, you know, these, when we start talking about visual culture and the impact of images, it's quite profound at points. And we should never really underestimate just how profound that moment can be. I mean, we've done a lot of work in public spaces. I'm not really interested in the white cube as the sole space for delivering an exhibition. I'm very interested in public spaces and places where, you know, you can encounter and work almost within the tools that advertising use. These are big installations which we did in railway stations. You know, but at the same time, you don't want to kind of constrain the artists that you've been working with by actually, you know, only seeing the work that they produce through the prism of the kind of overt political kind of message. I'm also very interested in just allowing people to make work, because again, the destination for that is an aesthetic kind of question around pleasure. This is this African term again, you know. I mean, Africa by Africa, a world photographic view. You know, we are age. I mean, we're a very contradictory organisation in many senses. You know, I think we always have to remember where the audience sits. And within a kind of short, relatively short span of time, it was interesting that the Barbican Gallery assured that we had to work very hard for them to actually take on. Got something like 40,000 visitors through the period of the show, which at that time was a groundbreaking show for a fee-paying audience. I think they underestimated just how popular the show would have been. So you end up with people like Samuel Fossil, Peter Mogabani, you know, I mean, names now that are quite celebratory, that have never had any form of display within the UK. So we slip and slide across the political agenda. There is no one strategy that we use. If it's a museum and the show is right, then we work within that space. But I think what we want to do going forward is to carry on, if you like, kind of contesting, you know, this very, very interesting identity politics question. Because I think, I mean, Clement Cooper's work here, we also have to realize, I'm going off script a little bit, but we also have to realize the kind of regional aspect of what we do. There's London and then there's the rest of the UK. It's not, I mean, the rest of the UK isn't London. And the things that are happening within these spaces are really important exchanges. Throw to his work again. So as we discussed, black is considered to be a political and cultural, not a generic or biological category. It's a contested idea whose ultimate destination remains unsettled. And I think in the 90s there was a really kind of, there was almost as if people didn't want to discuss this identity question anymore. It's almost as if it had gone away. And of course with 9/11 and all the various kind of conflicts that are going on in the world now, the question of identity simply won't go away. There's almost the desire for it to be not discussed. It's almost as if it becomes a taboo. Almost as if, you know, culture and power and identity politics are something which somehow need to be kind of curatorially put aside, or they're not in vogue anymore. And that's what we find the kind of cultural institutions kind of rely on, looking towards the new all the time, creating a kind of space for something to occur that is en vogue. Well, that's because the nature of cultural industries needs something new to keep on turning over, which ties into the question that I asked before. What do we do when the margins get pulled into the centre? When there's this kind of vortex spinning around all the time of cultural institutions that want to pull in the new, that want to pull in the black artist into this space, that want to perpetually pull in the artist from India. The globalisation of the art world now is a very, very interesting kind of scenario, because in many ways, you can just see the commodification of regional spaces. You can see contemporary Iranian art now. You can see artists from Bangladesh, India, Pakistan now. And then you can see, particularly around the opening up of China, the explosion of interest in contemporary Chinese art. These are two gay artists which strip themselves to the point where they become armless, legless subjects. So, I suppose when we get to a place, or when we arrive in a place that enables the organisation to carry on commissioning new work, we then began to question the institution of what we are. What does it mean to be an institution? What does it mean to be an agent? What does it mean to be an institution? How do we evolve? How do we grow? What do we do? So around about 2002, we began to think about the legacy of what we were and the legacy of what we could become. Should we become a building-based organisation, or should we stay as agents? And you begin to realise that actually, if you don't put down some fundamental blocks, if you don't build things to house the ideas that you're in, whether they're websites or buildings or institutions, then they become very vulnerable to political change. It becomes very easy to erase those spaces. So I became very concerned after about 15 years within the organisation that actually what we effectively were still a desk, still a few phones, and still a few employees. What do we do to up the ante in terms of building an institution? And if we build an institution, then do we become the thing that we've been historically critical of? This was one of the shows which was major for us turning towards the question of human rights. Working with Marcellus Brodsky about the disappeared in Argentina was a shift, really, a complete shift in terms of the expectation of our audience, in terms of the expectations of our funders, and the types of messages that we were beginning to send out from the organisation. Why would Autograph be dealing with the disappeared in Argentina? And at the same time, looking at the history of people like Michael X, not Malcolm X, Michael X, a character framed centrally here, who was a British black person. So as I said at the beginning of the talk, slipping and sliding between these historical kind of places. Publishing has been essential. We've published over 60 books now. And I think, again, creating that permanent legacy. This was also the point where you realise if you don't publish, if you wait for people to publish what you're doing, if you actually don't lay it down, most of these books don't sell. They don't sell. It takes about 5 years to sell 400 copies. But eventually they go. Right? So it's not about the economic imperative. It's not about making money. It's about leaving it down. It's about making a mark. So in time, you can revisit it. This is a series of photographic books that were designed as their stories. Small books that you could just read. Working with people like Ito Barada around this question around exclusion, zones of exclusions. So it becomes a much more geographical, global organisation at this point. By actually begin to, you know, work with artists who are based in different cosmopolitan centres, by commissioning them to produce new work and showing it in the UK for the first time. Ito's work is now very, very celebrated. Arlene Godfrey's project. I've always been interested in it. I mean, I've got this love-hate relationship with the documentary tradition in a sense, but Arlene Godfrey had been working with this guy for like 20 years, and I couldn't resist this kind of journey that she'd been on through this guy's psychotic kind of failure. It's a beautiful project. Okay, so we're in the building. I'm going to take us there very quickly. Of course, we dress the site. We try and agitate what it could be. We ask people to think about visibility, invisibility, what institutions mean. We use the site as we buy it as a kind of new gallery, a gallery without walls. We do a lot of public art within it. We make it a very textural experience so that people can imagine what it is might be there. And then eventually we go through a kind of funding cycle, which is long and protracted, which I won't bore you with. But we do take £1 million from Barclays Bank, a bank that's got a historic legacy of supporting the apartheid regime in South Africa. We do take that money. We do take money from apartheid bank because we do take money from our own state. So where is the contradiction within that? There's a lot of internal debate around that very question. So in my view, we take as much money from as much capital sources to build the centre as we possibly can. I'm unashamedly abashed and aggressive in that moment, because if I'm going to sell something, I'm going to sell it, right? And if you have to, the dots are about that far apart before you begin to find, is it moral, is it not? If you're selling, you're selling. And we build the building, finally, it opened in 2007. There are two gallery spaces in it, there's a library, there's two arts organisations, one called Autograph, one called Innova, and we rent some spaces out there, and all of a sudden, we're kind of, you know, landlords in the cultural sector in London, and with all the problems that that means, all of the issues that you become about getting people into your building, viral campaigns about artists, advertising, audience developing, market research, programming that gets people through the door. Numbers become an issue. Funders become much more concerned. Staff become a different kind of kettle of organisational agendas. HR becomes an issue. The risks go through the roof. The whole ante of what you're trying to deliver kind of shifts. And that's what I mean by institutions. Somehow a building has the capacity to change the very nature of what you imagine it can be. But I'd rather the building was there than not. And this is the first new build visual art gallery in London since the Hayward Gallery was built, which is over 40 years. This is something about the nature of London and the cultural institutions as they develop. There we go. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mark. This was really a lot of input, but I would like to give open possibility to questions. So maybe I just open now. I don't because my questions I can ask tomorrow on the panel. So, but maybe there are some direct questions I would like to. Nobody?
Wow. There's one. I'll ask one to myself.
I don't know how clear it is. I'm just thinking still. But you clearly adopted a kind of a strategic essentialism in the beginning, where you use blackness as a political strategy. And then you turned to human rights later on, and I wonder how you avoid, universalizing things again, because human rights is such a generalized term. How do you work with that?
I think you have to just how do you avoid universalizing things again? Because human rights is a very good question. What happens in that moment? Where do you focus, and how do you embrace that very kind of like complex question? I think. By embracing the politics of human rights through specific projects rather than incorporating the wider issue of human rights is where we sit. So when we did Marcelo Brodsky's project around the disappeared in Argentina, it became through the prism of his experience. And when Marcelo talks about Argentina, and he's a great speaker, you should have him here, in Argentina we don't want truth and reconciliation, we want justice. Then they're very important points for people to think about. And I just think by actually locking the local and then looking at that in the global, And the reason why I was justifying what Marcella was doing, because I was looking at this question of state violence. What happens when the state turns violent on its own citizens was the underlying principle. Why would an audience or an organization like us invest in this question? It's because you don't have to make a huge leap towards looking at deaths in custody. You don't have to look at a huge leap between what happens when a state takes a kid off the street and the kid's dead. What happens in those moments? What happens when the state neglects to investigate a crime against one of its citizens, whether they're black or they're white, in the case of the Stephen Lawrence case? What happens when, you know, there is no recourse to justice? And the disappeared situation in Argentina had all kinds of echoes with the Stephen Lawrence case at home. It's like, what happens when the state fails you? And I think they are universal questions which you can generically ask without necessarily trying to solve them all, but just using, if you like, one or two artists as catalysts for that question. First of all, I'm not a photographic historian, and I actually don't like curatorial packages that take you on a narrative journey with closure at the end. I prefer to leave the thing open. And I think that question around the human rights debate is obviously an open question, because it really does actually ask people at what point, whether it's capital punishment, whether it's, you know, violence, whether it's state violence, at what point do you, you know, the human rights question is, you know, what do you do about Palestine and Israel in those kind of moments, right? And if you look at it within what I like about it as well is this, the Declaration of 1948 is like yesterday in terms of history, in terms of what the world was subscribing to post-World War II. They imagined that they would build a new world order, and it's failed in many instances because of the dynamics around the Cold War and other situations.
Part of the question has been already answered, quiet question, but I would like to go back to work on the missing or disappeared persons, and maybe you could elaborate more on the aspect of broadening the scope of your work there. And
the aspect of?
Broadening the scope, widening the scope of what Autograph is presenting and showing, and the discussion that is, what kind of policy do you develop on that, and how did it change?
I don't think there's a policy as such, because that suggests that there's something kind of written down. There isn't a manifesto in that moment either. I think what there is there's a kind of almost an identification with that as a process. You see, I mean, I think what a show like Marcelo Brodsky's did was it enabled people to articulate their sense of vulnerability as subjects, even within the UK, from various different kind of community backgrounds, why they felt under threat. So it was a vehicle, if you like, to look at that extreme case, to talk about local conditions, which in theory are not that far away. You can easily imagine, and we're not far away from it now, you can easily imagine a situation, someone mentioned today, oh, she's gone home, the artist who was talking about surveillance. What was her name, Lush? Lushka, when she was talking about 40 days without right to recourse. They were actually fighting for 3 months. When has 3 months become 3 years? I mean, without going into the obvious examples, because I don't want the conversation to be swayed by what happens when states take people away. I mean, these are real local concerns for kids and communities at that time. Sus laws, you know, her bag was stopped and she, you know, she's photographing stuff. But imagine if you're, you know, coming from a particular constituency and you're, you know, you're off. So it's kind of like that. It's just asking people to think, how far away are we actually from this condition? And if you look at it, if you replicate it, and where it's, and these, and the, you know, the chain of events across Latin America as a strategy. So it's about, you know, it's about, number one, educating people about what happened in that moment, who were the subjects and why, and then imagining that if you're not careful, and it does happen here. I mean, we have a case of a guy that was just been shipped off back to Angola, who was killed on his way out of immigration just 2 weeks ago. I mean, for me, that's not to do with anything else other than a state crime. So how do we get recourse to that? Now, that's not about numbers. That's the game, isn't it? It's not about 50,000 people died today in Rwanda in 270 days or something. It's about one person dying at the hands of state agents.
Same symptom over here.
Yeah. So, you know, you start to join the dots around where these occurrences, you know. This is what I mean by it's quite a melancholic kind of place, because I think our job, the underlying principle of what I want to do with Autograph, in a sense, is keep the politics there. Now, the politics are not specific. We don't have a manifesto. They're about responding to artists who are inquiring about what I think are important social phenomena that reflect and we should be responsible for. I think it's my job to actually put this stuff on the wall and have a conversation about it. I don't expect to be the expert on that. I leave the artist. I create the platform for the artist to kind of come through. That's the intervention. It's very easy to turn towards celebrity. I could commission Stan Douglas, David Hammonds, Isaac Julian, Yinka Shonabari, Chris Afili to make work. But why do that? They're already kind of out there. They're from the margins and they've been pulled into the centre. Right? They become something else in that moment.
Wow. I have some questions about those early years. How many people were there when you started? When did you exactly start it? How did you find your artist? And how did that change over the time, over the years? I mean, are there artists now sleeping on your doormat to get a chance for an exhibition? I mean, that's the art market out there. There are so many artists, they don't have galleries and stuff and so on. And so I'm interested in these earlier structures that you had.
Well, there were networks of friends at the beginning, to be
okay.
honest.
Okay.
And people's front rooms were conference spaces. There were, I mean, you know, you can imagine, you don't have to make a huge leap of faith. Look, you put 15 people in the room and a little bit of money and you've got crabs in a barrel. Okay, I mean, people will tear themselves apart, even with a shared political objective. It's very interesting. Cooperatives don't work, really, for me. They're really problematic spaces. And we, actually, they do work. In time, they can work. But we didn't have the time to get locked into the development of a cooperative movement with a shared political objective. What became very clear is that we would pay one or two people, myself and another, and that person would be responsible for the direction of the way that the agency would be developing.
Okay, and that happened in the late 80s?
That was 80. That it actually happened around about 85. Money started to arrive around 88.
Okay, thank you.
And of course, the agency has grown as we've been successful. I mean, one of the things I say to students when I'm talking to young students is I'm really surprised, actually, at the lack of formation of groups with a shared objective, even in the shorter 1, 2, 3 years, to work together. I mean, I can be very dictatorial, I can be very decisive about the things that we have to do, and that's fine. I think you do have to make decisions. We didn't have the time to sit and pontificate about what was right or what was wrong. We bury the moment that doesn't work. This huge, I could give you a wonderful presentation of failure, but that's fine. The failure points are really important. That's fine. But going forward, we just had to be really, really decisive with the small resources that we had. And we created a myth. There wasn't that much work, actually, to be honest. And there weren't that many photographers. Okay, I would be going to someone's house and I would go, is that it? I mean, you know, is that everything you've got? Yeah, man, I'm a photographer. It's like, okay, we'll look at that later. But, you know, we created the myth of the need. Who would deny that? Because no one had the knowledge. You might have to cut that from the audio.
Okay, I have a quite broad question, but I will take the chance that you're here, because I'm very much wondering about the notion and the practice of exhibition in itself when it is linked to stage bodies and identities, because I have to think on the fact that it came up in the 19th century together with the world expositions.
Of course.
And when you're now saying, and you said it in a very critical way, I think, okay, now in this new range of globalization, we have again exhibitions like contemporary, let's say, Canadian art or something like that. And then I'm asking myself, do you see links between this 19th century concept and the concept of exhibition now? And is there, had happened anything after the Documenta that was curated by Invasor?
What, say that last bit again, Sage? It was Documenta 11.
The 11th well. Documenta, if that changed anything.
Well, okay, there's a lot in there. Yeah. I mean, yes, there is a degree of replication around the exotic on display within institutions,
yeah, but
as I mentioned.
This term of the practice of exhibition.
Yeah, well, there's a professional exoticization has gone on, okay, within exhibitions. It's clear. I mean, you don't have to look too far to look at, you know, as we say, contemporary Iranian photography or contemporary Iranian artists. I mean, most of the artists that I know, depending on the kind of offer that's on the table, would say yes to the Tate if they were doing that, and no to the community centre if they were doing that, and it could be the same objective. I think that the most important question, or the most important part of that answer, is artists' capacity to say no to those institutions, to be framed within that moment. That's a really big, but the opportunity is offered, and the artist will 9 times out of 10 run towards that opportunity. Okay, and it's always sold as an opportunity. Personally, I think it's problematic. And I think and it's not surprising that you find once an artist reaches a certain degree of visibility, that they almost become post that condition that they've been framed within, that they turn away from those group black shows or those group geographical shows, that they end up having debates around the idea of being post black, for example, which is what Thelma Golden and Glenn Ligon were talking about and misquoted all over the place. What Thelma and Glenn were talking about was being in a position where you have a body of work where the work is discussed without you being seen as a black subject within the production of that work. So how do you become an artist and be and arrive in this post-black space? How do you make work without people saying, Isaac Julian, the black gay artist from London, right? Instead of actually interrogating what the work's actually doing. So there's problems with that. I mean, that's what I mean by curatorial laziness. I mean, there are lots of relationships towards the kinds of issues that people are working with that could be brought together. But institutions change very slowly. And I think, actually, we're in a new conservative mode. And what changed after Documenta 11? I think quite a lot. I do. I think Malik Sedi Bey won a Golden Lion in Venice. I think people began to understand that there was a huge constituency of artists from all over the place. Serena Bimji, very successful. I think collectors actually turned and had a good look at what was going on outside of the traditional North American, European kind of schools of production, and started possibly people like Arthur Walter, a major collector who's just opened up a new private collection. Where is the collection? It's here. He's built a new museum, new house. It's fantastic. So he's showing Rotimi Fanny Kiodi's work next door to August Sander. Fantastic. Like, thank you.
I think in Cologne.
Yeah, just outside.
Yes.
An amazing project. So it means that people like that were beginning to buy, and that's creating, you know, once the collectors have an influence, then the museums have an influence. So I don't think the change is huge. It's not like, oh God, everyone woke up and we were in a totally different place today, but there has been a change.
Thank you very much, Mark. I think we have to make a break now because
We have, otherwise we have problems because we have a reservation in the restaurant. Nevertheless, I think there are a lot of questions still, and we can continue personal talk by personal talk in the restaurant and also tomorrow on the podium discussion. And Mark, I thank you again very much for your talk. Great. Big applause.